Thanks, Nick, and thanks everyone for having me. Is the sound all right? Good, cool. So today I'll be talking about some work I did with my advisor, Anton Kapustin, and two of his other grad students, Yuan and Min Yang. To start with, let's consider an example which I think will be familiar to a lot of you. So back in 2008, 2009, Fedkowski and Kataev were thinking about Majorana chains, which are short-range entangled, they're Hamiltonians defined on a 1D lattice with short-range entangled ground states. So it's convenient to define them in terms of real fermions, these operators gamma that I've defined in terms of the creation and annihilation operators. They considered time reversal invariant systems where time reversal acts as so. And they were interested in translation invariant free fermion Hamiltonians. By free, I mean quadratic in the operators gamma. So generic Hamiltonians look like this with some parameters U and V. And if you tune the parameters correctly, you can make this Hamiltonian H hat gapped and T symmetric. So we'll be interested in those types of systems. What they considered were certain stable deformation classes of such systems, which are known as phases. So the equivalence relation has two parts to it. First, you can tensor the system by an ancilla. So that means just adding additional fermions gamma to the Fock space and modifying your Hamiltonian by adding some H-naught. This ancilla system has a special property that the ground state is just a product state of unoccupied sites. So you can do this, and that's the stable part. The deformation part is that you can continuously deform those parameters U and V while preserving the gap in the symmetry. So they give an example of a non-trivial system, this Hamiltonian H1. What non-trivial means here is that it can't be deformed by adding ancillas or continuously deforming in a gapped way to the ancilla system. Moreover, that one can construct a whole family of Hamiltonians H sub n, where n is a natural number, and each of them lies in its own class. We'll actually be interested in difference classes of such systems. So they're not given by natural numbers, but by integers n minus m. Physically, you can think of a difference class of systems as a type of boundary that can live between two different gapped systems. And these Hamiltonians H sub n end up exhausting all possible invertible or short-range entangled free fermion Hamiltonians in this dimension. By invertible, I mean simply that the ground state is non-degenerate. So interesting things happen when one turns on interactions. So that means the Hamiltonian is allowed to have terms that are higher than quadratic. So a term with some parameter T and a quartic term perhaps, maybe even higher terms. If one now deforms in this larger parameter space of Hamiltonians, some equivalences that weren't there before begin to appear. So here I've drawn in this inner oval the space of free Hamiltonians. The blue blobs are distinct phases. One can't move between them without closing the gap or breaking the symmetry. But if one includes this larger parameter space of interacting Hamiltonians, then there exists paths through the blue area that connect previously disconnected phases. So what happens in this case is that this phase H8 ends up being equivalent to the ancilla system H0. So the classification of free phases given by integers collapses to the Z8 classification. And the T symmetry ended up being important here. If we had allowed deformations that ignored the T symmetry, then there would only be two phases in both the free and interacting classifications. So this was an early example that was considered, but since then it's been generalized substantially. So one can do similar things in all dimensions and for the tenfold way symmetry classes. The free classifications are given by K-theory. So this Z that we saw before was simply KO0. And the interacting classifications can be given by something related to spin cobordism, technically this thing on the right. So for example, one can look at the BDI row, that's the sort of time reversal symmetry that our systems had, and see in one dimension that there was a Z classification. Though when one passes to interacting Hamiltonians, one sees in the red that it collapses to Z8. And this sort of thing is actually fairly common. You see it happening in class D3 in three dimensions and even in higher dimensions. Moreover, the opposite thing happens where upon adding interactions, one gets a richer classification. New so-called intrinsically interacting or interaction-enabled phases arise. So those are marked in blue. In 6D class D, you had integers classifying the free phases, but two copies of integers classifying the interacting phases. So these intrinsically interacting phases in this table here are above physical dimensions. If one adds crystalline symmetries, as this group did in 2014, one can get intrinsically interacting SPT phases in physical dimensions. And of course, if one moves beyond short-range entangled or invertible phases, one can get intrinsically interacting phases. But what we'll be interested in today are phases just with on-site unitary symmetries.
Just included three of the 10 classes here, or just?
Just to keep things simple, I didn't want to include particle hole symmetry. Yeah.
Same question?
Same.
One can do the story with the remaining seven classes, and one has like pin C cobordism and that sort of thing. Okay. So I'm gonna do two things. Understand the free fermion SRE classification with an on-site symmetry, and it will turn out that we don't have to do things from scratch. We can use the existing results about the periodic table, add a little representation theory to it, and that gives us the full classification. Furthermore, I'd like to study the map into the interacting classification. So what that means is we can regard any free phase as an interacting phase where the interactions are simply turned off, and then understand which equivalence class our free system lands in. So it turns out that unstable free phases are actually fairly common, as are intrinsically interacting invertible phases, even in physical dimensions. So let's generalize beyond this example that I gave at the beginning. The sort of systems, the free fermion systems we're interested in have band Hamiltonians. What this means is that we can always write a free Hamiltonian in terms of the gamma operators and some matrix X, and because of the self-adjointness of H, this matrix X has to be skew Hermitian. Moreover, since we doubled the number of variables, as in the BDG picture, there's a particle hole condition, which constrains the form that X can take. So in the Majorana basis, it's actually a sort of reality condition. So it tells us in particular that at the particle hole symmetry fixed points, this matrix X is real. So it's a real anti-symmetric matrix. I'll mention two other symmetry classes that will come into play later. This is class A, where we tend to write things in the Dirac basis, and there's no constraint on this matrix X, which we're calling H for class A, and class C, where we have a particle hole symmetry constraint, but it squares to minus one. So what exactly do we mean by on-site symmetry of a free fermion system? So first, let's restrict ourselves to zero dimensions where things are much simpler. All of the hard part happens in zero dimensions, and it's easy to generalize. In general, the total symmetry group is not just bosonic symmetries and fermion parity. In general, they can mix non-trivially. What that is a central extension of the bosonic symmetry group by fermion parity. So we'll be considering systems with a total symmetry G hat. A symmetry R hat acting on the Hilbert space can be represented on the band space as some matrix R. So because of the fact that R hat is a symmetry of a free Hamiltonian, it's always represented linearly on the fermion's gamma. So we have some matrix R with indices A, B acting on the gammas. If we impose that R preserves fermionic commutation relations, that means that R has to be an orthogonal matrix. So R forms a real representation. Moreover, we require that fermion parity, P, acts by just negating the gammas. So the only representations that are allowed are those where R of P is minus the identity. Then we can start to work irrep by irrep by decomposing R into real irreps with a certain multiplicity. Then we can think of the Hamiltonian as blocks that are acting on a space R alpha, where R alpha is an irrep, tensor product, a multiplicity space of dimension N alpha. So Schur's lemma tells us something about irreps. If we're working over C, the familiar expression is that any matrix that commutes with the representation has to be proportional to the identity. In general, the statement is that the commutant, the space of matrices commuting with the representation, forms a division algebra. So if we're working over R instead of C, there are actually three possibilities. We'll call these R-type, C-type, and H-type representations. R, C, and H are the algebras that the commutant can be. So first, R-type representations. In this case, the commutant is just spanned by the identity matrix. Equivalently, when we complexify the real representation, it's irreducible. What this means for the Hamiltonian is that the block X sub alpha has to be written as the identity tensor some matrix A. That's happening on the space R alpha tensor multiplicity space. So identity is the only matrix that we can have acting on the representation space. The only interesting things that happen on this block of the Hamiltonian are in the multiplicity indices. And because of the symmetries of X, this matrix A has to be a real skew symmetric matrix. So what we've done by writing alpha hat like this is said that our Hamiltonian, written here in the original form, can actually be entirely written in terms of this matrix A. And matrix A doesn't satisfy any symmetry relations. It's just on the multiplicity indices. So it's just the sort of matrix that defines a class D system. So we've reduced this block of the Hamiltonian to simply a class D system, forgetting about the symmetry. This means that for each of these blocks, which correspond to real irreducibles, we get a class D invariant, which we can simply read off the periodic table. So the contribution to the total classification is for each allowed R-type representation, one gets in zero dimensions a Z2 invariant, in one dimension a Z2 invariant, and et cetera. Okay. So now I want to do essentially the same thing, but for the other types of representations, and it turns out we'll be looking at other rows of the periodic table. So for C-type, the commutant is not just spanned by the identity, but also some matrix curly J, which plays the role of the imaginary number I in the complex numbers. So now there are since we have these two matrices that commute with the entire representation, the general form the Hamiltonian X can take on that block is a sum of two terms. It's useful in this case to write things in a basis of Dirac fermions, psi. And when we do that, we can rewrite, again, the Hamiltonian we started with in this form in terms of the Dirac fermion psi. Here, H is a function of these matrices A and C, and it turns out to be a general Hermitian matrix subject to no constraints. So this script H that determines our Hamiltonian on this block is exactly the data that defines a class A system. So some Hamiltonian without a particle hole symmetry constraint. So this means that each allowed C-type irrep contributes a class A invariant to the classification. Now, the third type is H-type. So here the commutant is spanned by four types of matrices. The most general form that the Hamiltonian block can take has four possible terms in it. So we can do something similar and rewrite the Hamiltonian in a more efficient form, this time in terms of Nambu-Dirac spinners. So in the end, our Hamiltonian is just a function of some matrix Z. And Z is not quite generic. It's actually satisfies a single constraint, which we can interpret as a particle hole symmetry constraint, where the particle hole symmetry squares to minus one. So we've reduced all H-type blocks of the Hamiltonian into exactly the data that defines a class C system. So these irrups will contribute these types of invariants to the classification. So let's summarize what I've just said. We see that we can just read off the periodic table and see that in zero dimensions, we're getting a Z2 invariant, a class D invariant for each real irrep, and we're getting a Z invariant for each C-type irrep. That's a class A invariant, and et cetera in higher dimensions. So after this long argument, all we need to know is what's written in the table here, and that tells us how to get the classification for any symmetry. Yeah?
Say that you can reduce the Hamiltonian into these irreducible blocks, the mm-hmm. D, A, or C type.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a restriction on the classification of the entire Hamiltonian based on what types of blocks are in it? Like, can you only have the D type blocks in a Hamiltonian that is D3 or something like that? Or can you have every type of block in all of the 10 classifications?
So for a general symmetry group, you may or may not have R, C, or H type irreps.
Okay.
So if your group were like, these are not the tenfold wave symmetry classes. We're dealing with other symmetry groups. If your symmetry was Z3. The trivial irrep is R-type, so you would get class D invariants for every time that this trivial irrep appeared. But there's also a two-dimensional C-type irrep, so you would get class A invariants every time that appeared in the band space.
But the point is, just given the periodic table, there's some formulaic way of reading off what the entry is and then
doing this plot. We break it up into blocks, and each block contributes something from the known periodic table. We don't have to define any new invariants. Yeah. So let's see how this works out in practice. So we could have superconductors, so that's a Z2 fermion parity symmetry with an extra internal Z2 symmetry. So the total group is Z2 cross Z2. This has two allowed irreps. Remember, allowed means that fermion parity has to act as minus one. The other generator can act as plus or minus one. That's our choice. So these are two different UREPs, and they're both of R type. So now just by looking at this table at the top of the page, we can read off that you get a Z2 cross Z2. That's a Z2 for each of the R-type UREPs in 0 and 1 dimension. But in 2D, each of these UREPs counts as a Z invariant. We can do the same thing with charge 4E superconductors. So here the group is the non-trivial extension of Z2 by Z2. And we get an integer classification in 0D and 2D, nothing in 1D, pretty much what you would expect. Class A insulators, we can put in the group U1 where the negative one element is interpreted as fermion parity. This has allowed C-type UREPs for each charge of fermion. So you actually get a whole bunch of factors of the integer corresponding to insulators where the fermions are of different charge. One striking thing about this classification is that in 3D, no matter what your on-site unitary symmetry is, you get no phases. The classification is just trivial. So what that means is if you have an SPT, say from group supercohomology, then it can't have come from free fermions. So recently people have found phases that can't be realized bosonically, so they're intrinsically fermionic. And then what this tells us is that they're intrinsically interacting fermions. So they can't be free fermions or bosonic phases. And a side note in how this fits into the picture of equivariant K-theory. So when the group G splits as a product, then allowed UREPs of the total symmetry group G hat are just simply all UREPs of GB. So in this case, what we're doing has been known since the 60s. So Siegel showed that real equivariant K-theory decomposes into three parts. One part in terms of real UREPs, one in terms of C-type, and one in terms of H-type UREPs. So we've just reproduced that in a more physical language. By considering more general extensions G hat, we've done a sort of twist to K-theory. Another note, if you're familiar with the interacting classification of phases, you know that a lot of these have decorated domain wall or layered constructions. So there, one just needs the non-symmetric classification by spin cobordism, and then one can use the Atiyah-Herzebruch spectral sequence to get spin cobordism of BG. The reason we had to go through all this is because the story is not as simple in K-theory. Yeah?
I'm remembering correctly, there's a type of sort of, this is not the most general twist in K-theory, but you could also twist, for instance, by declaring some of your elements G to act by odd operators. Is there a reason you're not doing that?
So that would be like a supersymmetry. Yeah. I'm just not considering supersymmetries. Yeah. Okay. So at the beginning, I mentioned my two goals. That was the first goal, classifying free symmetric phases. The second goal is to understand what these free invariants, and there are many, many of them for sufficiently complicated groups, what they have to do with the better studied interacting symmetric invariants. So it's old news that 0D invertible phases with a unitary symmetry are completely characterized by the charge of their ground state under symmetry G hat. There's no other invariant that's stable under this equivalence relation. So that's just one group cocycle. But we just learned that there are a whole bunch of invariants of free 0D SPTs. For each R-type UREP, there's a Z2 invariant, and for each C-type UREP, there's an integer invariant. So turning on interaction should be some map from these free invariants, which I'm calling rho sub alpha, to a cocycle omega. So the question is, what exactly is this map? So let's focus on C-type blocks because it's a little simpler there. So there we have class A Hamiltonians, the invariant of which is just the number of negative eigenvalues of this matrix curly H. So that's always a non-negative integer, but the relative invariant is just the difference of two such things for a pair of curly H's. So we want to take a pair of curly H's and find the relative charge of their ground state. That's the relative interacting invariant. So to do this, we deform H into H prime along a path. And along this path, we're several times, rho alpha many times, we're flipping an eigenvalue from positive to negative. And each time this happens, our ground state is acted on by an operator, this operator here. In this equation, V is the eigenvector corresponding to the eigenvector whose eigenvalue got flipped from positive to negative. So this operator turns out to have charge determinant of Q. Q was what we got when we complexified. When we complexified our C-type IREP, it decomposed into two complex IREPs, one acting on the psi bars, one acting on the psis. So it's the determinant of that, which is the charge of that operator. So therefore, in total, if we flip rho alpha many times, the relative charge of the ground state is this determinant to the power of rho alpha. So there, this all fits into a bigger picture, which at first will seem a bit superfluous, but you'll see why we did this when we start talking about higher dimensions. So one can regard this representation as a complex vector bundle over the classifying space for the group, which means it has various characteristic classes, one of which is the first Chern class. So this determinant turns out to be the first Chern class of this representation regarded as bundle. Moreover, one can tell a similar story with R-type blocks. One finds that the contribution to the relative ground state charge is also a determinant. In this case, the representation is real, so the appropriate characteristic class is the first Stiefel-Whitney class. So what this hints at is that in higher dimensions, if we want a map from the free invariants to the interacting invariants, they will appear as certain characteristic classes of the representations acting on fermions. Okay, so that was zero dimensions. There was only one invariant, one interacting invariant there. The story is quite a bit more complicated in one dimension. So it's known that interacting 1D SVTs have several invariants. So first of all, there's a Z2 invariant, gamma. Gamma tells you mod 2, the number of fermionic boundary zero modes they are. So gamma equals 0 versus gamma equals 1 is the difference between the trivial Majorana chain and the Kataev chain. But when one has symmetries, there's an additional invariant. So I'll just focus on the case where gamma equals 0. So there are an even number of boundary zero modes. In this case, one can ask how the symmetry acts projectively on the boundary modes. And this is the data that describes this is a two cocycle omega. So the setup will be to work on the boundary. So on the boundary, we have a zero dimensional system. So the symmetry group G hat acts on the boundary zero modes by some real representation. And we can decompose it again into IREPs. So here, nu sub alpha is counting the number of boundary modes that transform in the representation labeled by alpha. Meanwhile, we just learned that free 1D SVTs are characterized by class D invariants for each R-type EREP. Class D invariants are exactly the thing that distinguishes the non-trivial trivial Majorana chain. So it counts the number of boundary modes mod 2. So we can get a quick relation between rho and nu just from the meaning of the class D invariant. So with the setup in mind, we can start to understand the interacting invariants in terms of the free invariants. So this first invariant gamma just counts the number of boundary modes mod 2, so it's m mod 2. But in terms of this boundary representation r, we can write it as dim r mod 2. Or if we wish to write it in terms of the free invariants rho, it's simply that expression over there. So we've mapped the rows into the gamma, the free invariants into the interacting invariants. So how about the other 1D invariants? How do we write omega in terms of the free invariants rho? So when gamma equals zero, which means there are an even number of boundary zero modes, omega records the projectivity of the G hat action, not on the bond space, but on the Fock space. So this 2 to the m over 2 dimensional boundary Hilbert space. Another way of saying this is that omega is the obstruction to lifting this representation curly R on the actual fermion operators to some object valued in the group pin C. This obstruction is exactly the second Stiefel-Whitney class. Actually, it's not exactly the second Stiefel-Whitney class. It's the image of it in U1 valued cohomology. Similarly, one may express the gamma equals one invariance in terms of the representation R. So kind of just as we guessed when we were talking about 0D, we're able to realize the interacting invariants as characteristic classes of some curly R acting on the bond space. So there are two interesting consequences to this result that omega is given by the second Stiefel-Whitney class. So first, there's a stacking law for interacting fermion phases, which was studied a while ago. It's non-trivial. So for bosonic phases, they're given in this group cohomology picture just by two cocycles. And to stack them, you simply add the two cocycles. But when fermions are involved, the addition of the cocycles is modified by this term beta cub beta, where beta is a certain component of our two cocycle omega. So there are various ways of explaining this with tensor networks and TQFT, but the explanation in our picture is a bit simpler. To stack two free systems together, one simply takes a direct sum of the bond space representations. And then just this formula, which holds for Stiefel-Whitney classes, explains the strange stacking law. Another consequence is that we see intrinsically interacting phases of order 2. One might have guessed, if the free classification has things of order 2, but you notice in the interacting classification something of higher order, like order 4, then it must be intrinsically interacting. But this tells us that even at order 2, one sees intrinsically interacting phases. And the reason is that W2 is not a generic two cocycle. It actually satisfies this an infinite tower of relations, such as the one written here. So if you start with a phase and it doesn't satisfy this relation, then there must not exist a free fermion realization. Let's step back from the classification for a minute and ask what these invariants mean. So we'll first talk about just beta, which is a component of the interacting invariant omega. So the meaning of beta has been discussed in the interacting context in several ways. So in the bulk, Beta tells you the charge, the fermion parity charge of the G domain wall. On the boundary, beta tells you whether the symmetry action is fermion odd. Yeah. On the physical sites, the symmetry action is always even, but it can be projective on the boundary. And beta tells you whether it's odd because of the projectivity. Now we'd like to add a third interpretation of beta, which is as a charge pumping invariant. This third interpretation only really makes sense if one is talking about free fermion systems. The other two pictures are just in the interacting picture. So to get this charge pumping invariant, one defines a path from the identity to our representation R. So this defines a closed family of Hamiltonians. It's closed because at the one end of the path, it's the identity. At the other end of the path, it's a symmetry, which means it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So one gets back to the original Hamiltonian. One can apply just compute the usual invariant for closed families of Hamiltonian to get the pumping index. And when one does it for this family of Hamiltonians, what comes out is exactly beta. I think in principle, one could ask how to get the whole interacting invariant omega as a sort of pumping index, though we're not quite sure how to do that at the moment. It's a little weird because beta as a one cocycle is exactly defined, whereas alpha, it is, or omega is not just a cochain, it's actually the equivalence class in cohomology of the cochain. So it's a little weird if one tries to get it from a pumping argument. Finally, let's say a bit about two dimensions. So two dimensions is hard, so we'll restrict ourselves to the simplest symmetry group. There, the interacting invariants are, first of all, some kappa, which tells you the chiral central charge of the boundary theory. So that is quantized as a half integer. One also has group cohomology invariants, alpha, beta, gamma. So they satisfy a certain relation between alpha and beta called the Gu-Wen equation. So in two dimensions, what the class D, A, and C invariants tell you is the number of chiral boundary modes. So using that interpretation, one can get kappa in terms of the free invariants rho. On the other hand, understanding the interacting invariants alpha, beta, gamma means that we need to better understand their physical meanings in terms of boundary physics. So in one dimension, we had this interpretation that came from previous knowledge that omega characterizes the projectivity of the G hat action on the boundary. In two dimensions, we don't have clear interpretations of the invariants alpha, beta, gamma on the boundary. So what that means is we can only guess as to the relation between the free invariants and the interacting invariants. We can restrict to guesses that are compatible with what we know about the stacking law. So a natural guess is that gamma is the first Stiefel-Whitney class of a certain representation. It's not clear what the physical interpretation of this representation r hat tilde is. Beta, there are two natural options. Could be either the obstructions to pin minus lifts or pin plus lifts of tilde r. And alpha, there really isn't a natural guess for what that invariant could be. I guess when the symmetry group splits, it might have something to do with the first Pontryagin class. Yeah, but for general symmetry groups, it's unclear. Okay, so let me just summarize and focus on some takeaways. So So each type of irrep gives you an invariant, either 0, z2, or z, and which of the three it is depends on the type of real irrep, whether it's R type, C type, or H type. And the nice thing about this is that these correspond to just different rows of the periodic table, the D, A, and C row, so we don't have to do any extra work in defining the invariants. Secondly, we've mapped these invariants row into the interacting classification. So if one, say, wanted to check whether a free phase, like this H8 that I talked about at the very beginning, is stable under interactions, one just looks at its image under this map. If one wanted to check whether an interacting phase is intrinsically interacting, one sees whether it lives inside or outside the image of this map. And we find that plenty of phases exist outside of the image. And finally, though there are known interpretations of interacting invariants, we provide additional ones in terms of the band Hamiltonians. And they just come from these characteristic classes of a certain representation of the symmetry on the fermion operators. So I'll stop there and take any questions.
Other questions?
SYK model.
Okay.
Is considered as a zero-dimensional interacting Majorana fermion model, which has many coupling constants, J, I, J, K, L. So can you cover some of your classifications by proper choice of interaction parameters in the SYK model, or does it belong to some corner?
So let's see, I'm only considering gapped Hamiltonians. So would there be a gap in that case?
Yes, by choice of, without taking this intending to infinity bit, you will have a gapped Hamiltonian.
So yeah, I guess one could regard these things as zero-dimensional fermionic systems.
So I'm wondering whether it can be used to illustrate your classification, because I'm looking for some physical handle on this.
Let's see. So do these have global symmetries? If not, it's known that there are just two phases of zero-dimensional fermionic phases. The two phases correspond to whether the ground state has fermion parity even or odd. That's all there is.
Very general, I see.
Yeah. But it, yeah.
And the classification for SYK systems is known. Like, there is a Z8 classification that makes sense for SYK models. In terms of the number of, it's like different than this picture, but it's in terms of the number of Majoranas. You can think about it as like there's some block diagonalization of the Hamiltonian with respect to charge or fermion parity, and then there are different like assortments of GUE, GOE, and GSE statistics within the blocks. But it's kind of almost by construction much simpler. But it's just, yeah, it's like a standard.
I mean, if you want to ask that question, you might as well ask it about the Witt and Gorau models, which have this SON cubed or something like that symmetry. And then no disorder, they actually have a huge global symmetry group. And
okay.
You can ask what's their property.
I see.
And can you prove that they're different in some sense from SYK models in some interesting way?
In the free fermion classification, these 10 classes, one way I can think about it is the Hamiltonian living in the tangent space of like 10 different compact symmetric spaces, which correspond to these labels. But that's for the Hamiltonian written first quantized language.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I can say that, depending on if it realizes these symmetries, these are the different spaces of them. But I think that makes sense for interacting Hamiltonians, where the Hamiltonians are acting on like the full Hilbert space.
Yeah, I don't. So if there's not an analog of the first quantized Hamiltonian, then I don't see how that picture would make sense. Yeah.
There is a sensible way to talk about types of symmetries for interacting systems, but I might just not be able to talk about the Hamiltonian as
or... Yeah, it's just a very different language.
Thank you.